equipment. They could drive down to Fairbanks anytime they feel like it, and from there go anywhere in the world, check out the pyramids, see the Mona Lisa, visit old friends and family. Instead, they're up in the most godforsaken place I've ever seen. Doing what?
Prepping? Ivy said.
That's the only thing I can think, Dinah said. Prepping for a 5 to 10,000 year stay.
They're not the only ones, Ivy said.
It took Dinah a few moments to catch her friend's meaning. Then it was clear just from the look on Ivy's face. Are you shitting me? Cal? Ivy made just a suggestion of a nod with her eyes.
Mixed in with the stuff you'd expect from a fiancé, which is none of your business. He asks me questions about things like the comparative merits of lithium versus sodium hydroxide scrubbers. He requests copies of Louisa's PDFs about the sociology of persons confined in small places for long periods.
He can't think you're not going to notice that.
Sure. I'm going to read between the lines.
What do you suppose he's thinking?
Well, Ivy said, he does have sole authority over a huge submarine designed to ride out global thermonuclear warfare. And when the United States ceases to exist, I guess there'll be no one above him, chain of command-wise. What's a commander to do?
But how would it work?
I think a lot depends, Ivy said, on whether the oceans boil dry. If I were him, I'd make for the Marianas Trench and keep my fingers crossed.
I think it would be even harder than staying alive in space. Ivy looked at her friend with dry amusement. What? Dinah said.
Staying alive in space is going to be a piece of cake, remember?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I forgot to put on my makeup. It would present some fascinating challenges, she corrected herself, switching to her best NASA PR voice.
I think it's like what we're doing, Ivy said. You have to break it down into a lot of little things and solve them one at a time, or you get overwhelmed.
Is that what we're doing?
Yeah.
Ivy rolled her eyes. What's on your mind, other than the need for comic relief?
You, how you're doing? Your health? Ivy said.
Oh my God, is this an actual meeting? Are we on official business here? Ivy ignored her.
You haven't been logging much T2 time.
T2, the second Taurus, which Reese had been responsible for building, had started to spin on day 140. Its simulated gravity was 1/8 of Earth normal, only a little greater than that on the first Taurus. It was bigger and spun more slowly, which Reese hoped would make it a little more comfortable. Simply being in it helped counteract some of the negative effects of living in space for extended periods of time. People who lived without gravity suffered a gradual loss of bone density and muscle mass. Eyes went out of shape, and vision deteriorated. Space station crews tried to fight this by using exercise machines that placed stress on the bones, but these were stopgap measures meant for people who were only going to be in space for a few months. Dinah, Ivy, and the other 10 members of the original Izzy crew had now been up here for close to a year. During the first few months after Zero, no one had paid much attention to long-term health issues. Everyone was going to die. Scouts were showing up dead on arrival. It had been all emergency all the time. But during the months of hamster tube building and structural consolidation, the life scientists had been quietly having their say. This wasn't the first time Dinah had been nudged in recent weeks about her failure to spend more time in the simulated gravity field of T2. It's just hard to go back and forth between gravity and no gravity, Dinah said. It makes me barf. And none of my stuff is in T2.
She was referring, as Ivy would know, to the shop where she worked on her robots. But isn't that mostly remote work? Writing code?
Yeah. I just like to be where I can see them out the window.
Don't they have little cameras on them?
Dinah had no answer for that.
Whatever you're doing here, Ivy continued, you could do from a cabin in T2, where the gravity would build your bones.
It's also Reese, Dinah admitted. Things have been a little weird with him, and I just don't want to...
Reese never even goes to T2, Ivy said. He's been hanging out with the inflatable structures team.
Okay, Dinah said. Give me a place to work on T2 and...
There's another thing,
Ivy said, and let out the sigh.
The sigh was what Ivy did when the powers that be were making her do something ridiculous.
It would never show up in the transcript of a meeting, but it changed everything. I don't even want to guess, Dinah said.
We have all become characters in a reality TV show, Ivy said. You might not be aware of it.
Nah, I haven't been watching much TV.
Well, it's all people have to do anymore down on the ground. The economy is shutting down, and people are just eating beans and entertaining themselves with screen time.
Okay.
I've been asked to pay more attention to message shaping.
Message shaping? What's that?
Ivy let out the sigh.
Okay, never mind, Dinah said.
People want to know what became of their uppity little shit-kicker.
Really?
Yeah, Ivy said. People like their ULS. They remember the thing you did with Tekla. Tekla porn is a big thing now, too, by the way.
I don't want to hear about it.
Anyway, people are asking, where is Plucky Robot Girl and her mechanical menagerie?
That explains some weird emails I have gotten.
From random strangers?
No, from my own family. I don't read the ones from random strangers. How about you? What's your role on the reality TV show, Ivy?
Ivy stared at her coolly. I'm the uptight bitch who can't handle it.
Oh.
To American viewers, I'm not fully American. To Chinese viewers, I'm a banana.
I'm sorry, Ivy.
That's the bad news.
Okay. And what is the good news?
All the people saying mean things about me on the internet are gonna be dead in 433 days, she said, deadpan. Okay, it was an example of that dark humor thing. After that, none of it matters, except my ability to be of service to our heritage.
Okay, baby. How can I help you? Dinah asked. We could take a selfie, you and me, and I could post it on the Uppity Little Shitkicker blog.
You and I are going for a ride on the first operational bolo, Ivy said, and you are going to be reminded of what 1G feels like.
Casting of lots.
During the first few days after the moon had blown up, Doob had spent hours gazing up at Potato Head, Mr. Spinny, Acorn, Peach Pit, Scoop, Big Boy, and Kidney Bean. They were visible in the daytime, just as the moon had formerly been. And even on the rare day when it was cloudy in Pasadena, or he was stuck indoors, he could pull up a window on the screen of his computer and watch them on a live video feed. After he had figured out that they were going to kill everyone on Earth, he had become a lot less interested in staring at them. He had, in fact, sometimes gone for weeks without looking up at the gradually spreading cloud of debris. Sometimes, while walking across a dark parking lot or driving down the highway, he would catch sight of the moon chunks in the sky and deliberately turn his gaze away from them. They filled him with horror and even a kind of shame over the fact that he had once found the whole thing such a fascinating science treat. He did not want to be reminded of it. Instead, he tracked the slow disintegration of the moon pieces through spreadsheets and plots shared with him by his graduate students and his colleagues. He did everything he could to reduce the whole state of affairs to two numbers. One of these
was the bolide fragmentation rate, or BFR, which was a measure of how frequently big rocks were being made into small rocks. The other was, quite simply, how many days remained before the white sky. On day 7, minutes after they had met, he and Amelia had watched Kidney Bean fracture into 2 big chunks, later dubbed KB1 and KB2, though attempts had been made at the time to give them cutesy names of their own. 3 weeks later, Scoop had collided with Big Boy and broken into 3 pieces, SC1, SC2, and SC3. Big Boy itself was now BB1, still fairly recognizable, plus a whole family tree of bits that had shrapneled off its smaller piece, BB2. These were given code numbers such as BB2-1-3, meaning the third biggest fragment of the largest fragment of the second biggest piece of Big Boy. Beyond about that level, it became difficult and somewhat pointless to keep track of them all. Mr. Spinney had caused all sorts of havoc before finally breaking in half. Its wayward children, MS-1 and MS-2, had gone winging off in opposite directions and ended up in big eccentric orbits around the rubble cloud's shared center of mass, occasionally looping in from a great distance and slamming into one of the slower moving pieces. MS-2 had broken Acorn into 3 pieces just 3 days before Doob's memorable Oval Office chat with the president. While he'd been flying back to L.A., a hunk of it, the size of an oil tanker, had slammed into the Indian Ocean and kicked up a tsunami that had killed 40,000 people on the west coast of India. After he got home from his trip to D.C., he and Amelia checked into a suite at the Langham, a palatial hotel in Pasadena, so that they could spend a few days together before he went on a round-the-world journey. All through their romantic dinner on the terrace, he made a concerted effort not to look at the remains of the moon. Later, they went back to their suite and made love. After 20 minutes post-coital cuddling, Amelia rolled over on her side and went to sleep, inviting Doob to spoon with her. But Doob, unable to relax, pulled his tablet onto his lap, put on his reading glasses, and started killing time on the internet. The French doors to the balcony were open, and at some point the breeze coming in through them obliged Amelia to snuggle deeper under the blankets. Doob got up and walked over to close the doors and was confronted by the sight of the moon cloud directly in front of him, hanging over the lights of L.A. and now something like 4 times the diameter of the original moon. It was arresting, partly because it had been so long since he had looked squarely at it. And so he stood there, for a while, observing. Peach Pit was still largely in one piece, but other than that, the original 7 sisters were no longer discernible. Out of curiosity, he consulted an app that told him when Izzy would be passing over, and saw that it was going to happen in about 10 minutes. So he stood there and waited for it. As he waited, his attention turned again and again to the pieces of the moon. What was their future? He knew that they would shatter into an uncountable number of fragments and become the white sky and then the hard rain. But what was the final distribution of sizes going to be? How many big ones and how many small? They had some models based on the simplifying assumption that all moon rock was basically the same, but clearly that wasn't true. They had done some analysis on the original chunks, trying to figure out why Peach Pit was so resistant to fragmentation, and determined that it was simply the inner core of the old moon, which was confirmed anyway by an analysis of its mass. Peach Pit was much denser than the other bits, suggesting that it consisted mostly of iron as opposed to rock. The moon had had an iron core, but relative to overall size, this was much smaller than the Earth's. Most of the moon was cold, dead stone. And yet the core was there, and was thought to consist of a ball of solid iron surrounded by a somewhat hotter jacket of molten iron mixed with various other elements. All of this had been stripped bare and exposed to space by the agent. For the first few hours, Peach Pit had literally glowed with radiant heat. Or so they guessed, since the dust kicked up by the cataclysm had cloaked it for a while. Some of the core's outer jacket of molten metal must have been torn away, dispersed into the rubble cloud as goblets and slugs and droplets of melt that soon cooled and hardened. As much was proved by metal-rich bolides that had since plowed into the earth and been dug up and analyzed. By the time the dust had literally settled to the point where Peach Pit and its siblings were clearly observable, an outer crust had formed over it, consisting of melt that had cooled swiftly as it radiated its heat into space. The cooling had continued ever since. Now, the better part of a year later, Peach Pit, or PP1, as it was now designated, was still warmer than the other parts of the moon. It had shown greater resistance to fragmentation. Other rocks bounced off it or dashed themselves to pieces on its gleaming surface. A few significant chunks, PP2, PP3, and so on, had been ripped off in the early days when it had still been soft, but now it was clad in a mile-thick armor of solidified iron that was proof against just about any calamity, short of a second agent. Dube became so absorbed in such thoughts that he almost missed the transit of Izzy across the sky. It angled directly over the rubble cloud, seeming to weave among the giant, tumbling boulders, though this was, of course, an illusion. It had long been the brightest man-made object in the sky, and it was brighter now that so many pieces had been added onto it. The effort had been impressive, stirring even, but seeing it against the scale of the disaster behind it forced him to ask himself what was the point. What was the longer-term plan for the cloud arc? The swarm concept was a nice architecture, much more survivable than one big ship. But where was it going to go? No one seemed to be talking about that. He understood why. Survival was the first imperative. Long-term strategy came next. The amount of iron in PP1 was, for all practical purposes, infinite. It would take humans many thousands of years to find uses for that much metal. But it was way up high, hard to reach. And yet they had to reach it. And it was closer, easier to reach, than the Arjuna asteroids that Sean Probst was so excited about. Feeling an idea take shape in his head, like an iron core congealing deep in a moon, he put it on hold and forced himself to turn his attention to more immediate questions. A few days ago in the Oval Office, he had formed a resolve to get his ass into space and begin making things happen up there, which was fine, but he had 3 months left on Terra Firma. He couldn't neglect his responsibilities here, some of which, the most important, were to his kids, to Amelia, and to their frozen embryo. But on top of that, he had been given other jobs, and if he screwed them up badly enough, e.g. because he was standing on hotel balconies in the middle of the night thinking about how much iron was in PP1, then they might not send him up to the cloud arc at all. He hadn't wanted to go, but once he had assented to the idea, he had begun wanting it more than anything, and he now feared that they would take it away from him. And if they sensed that fear, they could use it to control him. Better to overperform, to exceed expectations, to act like it was nothing at all. 72 hours later, he was looking out the window of a U.S. Navy helicopter banking through a misty Himalayan valley as it lined up its final approach to a runway in Bhutan. Or perhaps the runway in Bhutan was the more correct phrasing. There were about 750,000 people in this country, which meant that they were entitled to supply 2 candidates for the cloud arc. The arithmetic was a little fuzzy. If the same ratio were applied consistently all over the world, something like 20,000 candidates would be gathered in. If an arklet could accommodate 5 people, then 4,000 arklets would be needed in the swarm. Each arklet required a heavy lift rocket to get it into orbit, and some assembly and prep work once it had reached Izzy. Could it be done? If the entire industrial capacity of the world were thrown into the production of rockets, arklets, spacesuits, and the other goods needed? Perhaps, but probably not. Doob was privy to some recent estimates that put the numbers at closer to 1/4 of that figure. And anyway, could the arklets really support 5 humans each? Without a doubt, they were large enough for 5 humans to bang around in, but it was not at all clear that each could be self-sufficient in food production. Building a sustainable ecosystem in a tube the size of a railway tank car was no small task. Biosphere 2, a well-known experiment in the Arizona desert, had attempted to support 8 people on an ecosystem the size of a couple of football fields, and been unable to make it work long-term. But its mission had been clouded by political strife and odd quasi-spiritual factors. A more down-to-earth project, run by the Soviets, had determined that 8 square meters of algae, an expanse of pond scum about the size of 2 ping-pong tables, was needed to keep a single human supplied with oxygen. In the space between the hard inner hull and the inflated outer hull of a single arklet, there was more than enough room. But much more real estate would be needed if the arklet were also to produce food. And those calculations didn't even begin to address the real complications of keeping thousands of people alive in space for many years. It wasn't enough just not to asphyxiate and not to starve. People would need medicine, micronutrients, recreation, stimulation. Ecosystems would get out of whack and need to be repaired with pesticides, antibiotics, and other hard-to-make chemicals. The thrusters that kept the arklets out of trouble would need to be refueled, and not only that, but they would need maintenance and repair. The idea of a completely decentralized cloud ark was a chimera. It was not sustainable without a mothership, a central supply dump, and a repair depot. The only plausible candidate for that was Izzy, but Izzy wasn't designed for anything like that purpose. They'd been trying to make it over by cramming it with vitamins, but that only delayed the moment when they'd run out of all the goods they didn't know how to produce in space, and people would begin dying in quantity. From the fact that he had gotten nowhere raising awkward questions about this, Doob inferred that the architects knew about it, and were on it, and just didn't want to talk about it because public doubt and controversy were not going to help. Doob's job, clearly, was to act like everything was okay. Today, that meant scooping up 2 young people from the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. Did the little performance he was about to put on really mean that 20,000 people from all over the world were going to end up living happily in the cloud ark? He just had to shut down the little rain man in his head, Doob as in dubious, and not even think about it. They had taken off 2 hours ago from the George H.W. Bush, a supercarrier keeping station in the Bay of Bengal. Doob had viewed the ship through the eyes of a man who, in a few months, would be making a permanent move to its orbiting equivalent. She was a completely artificial island, thousands of people densely packed into a wad of pure technology. The professionalism of the crew and the efficiency with which she ran were amazing. Could something like that be duplicated in space? With people chosen by lot from all over the world and trained in camps over the course of a single year? He reckoned he would know more in about 30 minutes. The Navy chopper plunged into a fog-stuffed slot between mountains and knifed through steam and mist for a few minutes. The airport's sole runway came into view, startlingly close to them. The chopper flared to a perfect landing a stone's throw from the terminal building. Doob became aware that his jaw was clenched and tried to relax it. He had made the mistake of Googling this place and learned that it was bracketed by 18,000-foot mountain peaks, that only 8 pilots in the world were certified to land here, and that even they didn't attempt it unless the sun was shining on the runway. Obviously, the kinds of guys who flew choppers for the Navy operated according to different rules, but it had still been a white-knuckle approach as far as Doob was concerned, and it made him wonder how he was going to react to being hurled into space on top of a hastily constructed tube full of explosive chemicals. He shifted in his seat and felt a thick manila envelope slide out of his lap and to the deck with a solid thunk that almost woke up Tavistock Prowse. Tav had been sitting across from him for the entire duration of the flight and had been sleeping for the last half hour, prostrate from jet lag. He was a bulky man, not especially tall, but constructed like a wrestler. The bald spot on the back of his head, which had been faintly visible even when he'd been in college, had expanded mercilessly, leaving just a monk-like fringe of close-cropped hair around the back of his bullet-shaped head. Perhaps to draw attention away from it, he wore glasses with massive black frames. At one point a serious weightlifter, he had softened and spread in the last decade, and even more so since Zero. It was strange in a way to see him unconscious, for he never seemed to stop moving. Doob had a pretty good idea why. Tav was hoping he'd get picked. If he worked hard enough, popped up on enough news feeds, garnered enough followers on Twitter, maybe some important person would decide that the Cloud Ark needed a professional communicator, the first or the last journalist. To Doob, it seemed like long odds. A lot of people with PhDs and even Nobel Prizes were ahead of Tav in line. But you never knew, and he couldn't fault the guy for trying. He bent forward and retrieved the envelope from the deck. It was a centimeter thick. It was labeled Paro Bhutan in neat block letters. The flap had never been opened. He was supposed to have spent the last couple of hours reading its contents, familiarizing himself with the task to be performed. Instead of which, he had been looking out the window at the steamy green plains and lazily braided rivers of Bangladesh, hoping to make the most of the 2 or 3 minutes it would take to get the chopper's door open. He plucked it up off the floor, tore it open, and pulled out a sheaf of pages. This was enough to wake Tav up, but not enough to make him move. He gazed at Doob and watched him read.
"If it's wearing red, yellow, or both, it's a llama," he said. "Bow to it." "Isn't that a camel from South America?" "With one L. A holy man. Put the palms of your hands together and make a little bow."
"I don't believe in..."
"It's not going to kill you, is it? If he's got a big yellow scarf over his left shoulder, he's the king. Bow lower in that case."
"Thanks. Anything else?"
Sitting next to Doob was Mario, their photographer, a man in his 30s with a short, dark mustache, a New York accent, and no expectation whatsoever of being picked for the Cloud Ark. On the flight over, he had divided his time between reading his own copy of the same dossier and playing a video game on his phone. He had been on many more of these than Doob or Tav. Getting into the spirit of things, he pocketed his phone and piped up,
"People are gonna hand you things. Some of them might be really crusty and old and funny-smelling. Those things are probably really important. Really important."
"Then why are they?"
"Because they believe that you are going to take it all up into space and preserve it."
"Oh.
So, if anyone hands you anything, even if you have no idea what on God's green earth it might be, look impressed, bow, take it carefully, admire it, and then hand it off to the helper kid."
"Helper kid.
People have been deputized to follow you around and help you carry all of the priceless national treasures that are going to be bestowed on you. They'll look after the stuff and bring it all back here to the chopper so you can keep your hands free from making those little bows and shaking hands with the king or whatever. As soon as we get back to the aircraft carrier, we'll throw it overboard."
"Done this before, have you?"
"This is my 73rd abduction run."
"Let's go."
Mario stood up, carefully, letting his cameras and bags swing free, patting each one as it settled into place. Tav and Doob were undoing their seatbelts and watching him for cues. Mario took 2 steps toward the door, which the pilot had just swung open. Cold, damp air
scented with pine and coal smoke, was pouring in. Doob almost rear-ended Mario as he stopped suddenly and turned around to look him in the eye.
"One other thing."
"Yes?"
Doob said.
"What is about to happen is going to be incredibly fucking sad. Like, maybe the saddest thing you have ever seen. Try to hold it together."
Mario held Doob's gaze until Doob nodded and said,
"Thanks."
Then he turned around and bolted for the door so that he could get some good pictures of Dr. Harris emerging from the chopper. Dr. Harris paused in the open hatchway. Spread out in front of him were at least 2 dozen people in red and yellow clothing, drawn up in readiness to extend greetings. He put his palms together in front of his chest and bowed. In front of him, Mario's shutter began to whir. Behind him, faint digitized clicks spilled out of Tav's phone as he live-tweeted it. The king drove him up the mountain in his personal Land Rover, Doob riding shotgun in the passenger seat on the left, for Bhutan, as it turned out, was a drive on the left country. Mario sat in the back, angling to get both of them in the photo, and Tav sat next to Mario, muttering voice memos into his phone. The king apologized for today's murky weather, which was blocking potentially spectacular views of high mountains all around. "But I suppose that is a very small matter in the larger scheme of things," he concluded. They stopped at an intersection in the town of Paro to let 3 boys kick a soccer ball across the road in front of them. Piled up on the road behind them was a small motorcade of llama-packed Toyotas. "So much joy they take in this simple game," the king mused. "They know, of course. All of them know about the disaster that is to come. When they are thinking of it, it makes them sad. But at other times, they are, as you see them, oblivious." The boys got out of the way, and the king eased forward into the intersection. The town had a surprisingly alpine look to it, with deep brown, weather-beaten structures of wood built on stone foundations. "Until a few days ago," the king went on, "they might have consoled themselves by imagining that they would be the ones chosen."
"In the casting of lots,"
Doob said.
"Yes."
The king shot him a keen look.
"I was responsible for choosing, you know."
He glanced back at Tav. "That is off the record."
"No, Your Highness. I did not know that,"
Doob said.
"We received guidelines, I suppose you could call them, saying that it was not a literal casting of lots. The choice is best not left to chance. We must send only the finest candidates. Bhutan has only 2 places in the Cloud Ark. It would be foolish to waste them on someone unable to represent our people. So it was a selective process."
"Most people have come to the same conclusion,"
Doob said.
"A pool of promising candidates is identified, and then the choice is made from among them by some process which might be random, just so no one person carries the entire responsibility."
"When you are a king, you sometimes have such responsibilities whether you want them or not. In this case, though, I was able to involve some of the llamas. There are precedents for such a selection procedure in the way that certain reincarnate llamas are identified. The drawing of lots from an urn is sometimes used."
Tav couldn't resist asking from the back seat,
"What does the doctrine of reincarnation have to say about the situation we are faced with now?"
The king smiled.
"Mr. Prowse, this is only a journey of 10 kilometers. I am taking it slow. If we had a road trip ahead of us of 10,000 kilometers, an enjoyable thought, I might be able to impart enough information to you about what reincarnation means to my people that we would be able to have an intelligent conversation about it."
"Fair enough. Sorry,"
Tav said, glancing up from the screen of his phone when his brain detected a pause in the king's speech.
"You have to understand, my job is to communicate with geeks, people who like math. So I was trying to imagine,
when 7 billion die and only some thousands remain, where do the 7 billion souls go?"
"Yes."
They turned off what Doob guessed was the main road and onto a fork that wound through a wooded hamlet above the river.
This hooked onto a bridge that took them across a fast-running, cold-looking stream, green and milky with rock flour carried down from melting glaciers thousands of meters above their heads. Doob still couldn't get over the fact that in a little more than a year those glaciers would be gone, the rock beneath them exposed for the first time in millions of years, and no scientist would be there to record it.
"We don't believe in anything as simple as metempsychosis. The movement of an individual soul from one body to another. That's not what we mean by reincarnation at all."
"What do you believe in, then?"
Doob asked. Tav had lost interest and was belaboring his phone with his thumbs.
"A better analogy might be to a burned-down stump being used to ignite a new candle. But I won't be able to give you a satisfactory answer, Dr. Harris. The teachings are esoteric, deliberately hidden from the uninitiated, specifically to prevent false interpretations. How an enlightened lama would think about the question of the 7 billion is as far beyond my comprehension as are the quantum gravity theories that you study in your work."
On this side of the river, the ground rose almost vertically. The mountain barrier was cleft by a steep-sided valley that zigzagged up and away from them. The road leaped up into it and switchbacked up a stone cliff, fringed here and there with clusters of hardy evergreens that had found toeholds in crevices. Tendrils and torn veils of mist drifted across the face of the rock, providing occasional glimpses of a white tower, high above them, that had somehow been constructed on the precipice. It was one of those buildings, like some monasteries in Greece and Spain, whose whole point was to proclaim to those below, "This is how far we will go to achieve separation from the world." They drove up a road between long green terraces until the ground became too steep for wheels, and then the king stopped the Land Rover and set the brake.
"How's your cardio?"
"Could be better,"
Doob said.
"But I don't have a heart condition or anything like that."
"We are about 3,000 meters above sea level. You are welcome to await the chosen ones here in my vehicle, or..."
"I could use a walk, thanks,"
Doob said, and glanced back at Mario, who shrugged philosophically, and at Tavistock Prowse, who appeared to be biting his tongue. As they hiked up the trail, followed at a respectful distance by an entourage of lamas, children, photographers, and officers of the Bhutanese military, the king told Doob that the place they were going was called the Tiger's Nest, and that it was one of the most sacred sites in their religion, being the spot where Guru Rinpoche, the second Buddha, had, in the 8th century, flown in from Tibet on the back of a tiger. Later, a temple complex had been built around the caves where Padmasambhava, for apparently this was an alternate name for the same personage, had lingered to meditate. Doob pleased himself by suppressing the urge to point out to the king that tigers were not capable of flight. This was only partly because he was gasping for air. He did not really care about the plausibility of the story, given the astonishing beauty of the place through which they were hiking. It was one thing to be fed a line of religious hokum in a desert hellhole that had nothing to recommend it as a site for tourism. But in order to go for a few hours' walk with a king in Shangri-La, he would put up with any amount of fairy tales and metaphysical ramblings. Small temples and devotional sites emerged from the mist every few minutes. They stopped part of the way up to enjoy a serving of chai in a little cafe with a fine view of the Tiger's Nest. Tav, at the end of his rope physically, announced he would go no farther. Doob, Mario, and the king pushed on along the increasingly precarious walkway to the gates of the monastery itself. This, the king had already informed Doob, was off-limits, and in any case would have made a poor showing as a site for a ceremony, being rather cramped, dark, mazy, and ancient. Crag-dwelling hermit monks didn't go in much for grand ceremonial courtyards. Instead, there was a sort of wide spot in the ledge just before the entrance to the White Temple. Waiting there were the two archers, a boy and a girl, both in their early 20s, clad in what Doob assumed was traditional costume. For the boy, a robe that stopped at his knees, with a large white scarf over his shoulder and crossed to his hip. For the girl, a bolt of colorfully woven cloth, wrapped around her waist and falling to her ankles as a sort of columnar skirt, with a yellow silk jacket above that, draped with many necklaces of turquoise and other colorful stones. Had she been here, Amelia, in a single glance, would have noticed 100 details about the weaving, the embroidery, the jewelry, the drape of the fabric, the choice of colors. She would have charmed the king right out of his saffron scarf. She would have climbed out of the Land Rover back in Paro and made friends with the soccer-playing boys. Amelia, not Dub, was the person who ought to be doing all of this. But Amelia wasn't going to the Cloud Ark, and Dub was. The boy and the girl, Dorji and Jigme respectively, were backed by some leathery oldsters in similar but simpler costumes, presumably their families, and several llamas. Prayer wheels were spinning, bells were chiming back inside the monastery, monks were chanting. Everyone was crying. They all bowed to their king. Dub was glad Tav had not come this far. Some kind of conversation took place in the local language. Dub didn't even know what the name of that language was. Mario, oblivious to the emotional tenor of the proceedings, darted around snapping photographs, dropping to his knees or even throwing himself flat on the ground so that he could get mountain peaks or temple roofs in the backdrop of shots. Dub, who had no idea what was going on, couldn't take his eyes off the faces of the elders, who were doing their best to hold it together in the presence of their monarch, but clearly suffering through ruinous emotional pain as they prepared to say goodbye to Dorji and Jigme forever. It was almost worse than watching your kid die, Dub thought. Then there was finality, certainty, a gravesite to visit, whereas these two were just going to hike off into the mist. A thunder of helicopter blades would announce their departure, and after that the family members would get vague assurances that Dorji and Jigme were going into space to carry forward the cultural legacy of Bhutan. Assurances that, Dub was pretty sure, were going to be fundamentally dishonest. These people were going to go to their deaths in 15 months, consoling themselves with that belief. He now understood his job a lot more clearly. Why were the doomed people of Earth not going completely berserk? Oh, there had been some outbreaks of civil disorder, but for the most part, people were taking it surprisingly calmly. It was because events like this were happening in every city and province with more than a few 100,000 people, and they were being stage-managed well enough to convince people that the system was working. When he was a kid, he had read the Greek myth of Theseus and the Minotaur, which hinged on the premise that the people of Athens had somehow been persuaded to select 7 maidens and 7 boys by lot every few years and send them to Crete to serve as monster chow. This had always struck him as the weakest point of what was otherwise a great yarn. Who would do that? Who would choose their kids by lot and send them to such a fate? The people of Bhutan, that was who. And the people of Seattle, and of the Canelones district of southern Uruguay, and of the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, and the South Island of New Zealand, all of which Dub was scheduled to visit in the next 2 weeks to collect the maidens and the boys they had chosen by lot. They would do it if they could be made to believe it would protect them. As Mario had predicted, Dub was presented with some extremely old-looking artifacts by almost equally old-looking monks, who smiled at him through tears and backed away, bowing, once Dub had accepted their prayer wheels and sutras and carvings into his hands. The king took Dorji and Jigme by the hand, turning his back on the mourners or the well-wishers, or whatever they were, and nodded at Dub as if to say, "Your move." Dube bowed one last time, then turned around and began leading them down the mountain. Day 306. Arklet 1, which had been sent up on day 285, turned out to have a few teething problems with its maneuvering thrusters. And so, the first Bolo coupling in the history of the Cloud Arc took place between Arklet 2 and Arklet 3. Those had been launched on days 296 and 300, respectively. These first three Arklets represented competing designs, and so they all looked a little different. No matter. They were destined to be punched out in different factories and launched on different types of heavy-lift rockets from different spaceports, so minor variations in styling were to be expected. They all had the same general shape, though. A cylinder with domed end caps. That was for the ineluctable reason that they had to be pressurized in order to perform their basic function of keeping humans alive. And pressure, sooner or later, made everything round. Dinah thought that the pressure hulls looked like the big liquid propane tanks seen next to cabins in mobile homes in the rural mining camps where she had grown up. Others likened them to railway tanker cars or stubby hot dogs. They were just big aluminum cans with domes welded onto the ends. The walls of the can had a thickness of about a millimeter. The domes were a bit sturdier. The thickest and strongest parts of the hull were in the places where the domes overlapped the ends of the can. The analogy was to a plastic soda bottle, whose thin wall could be crumpled in one hand when the lid was off, but which became amazingly stiff and strong when it was pressurized. Or at least, that was what NASA was saying to people who were alarmed by the idea of living 1 millimeter away from the vacuum of space. The first three Arklets were launched naked and smooth, but the hundreds to follow would come up clothed in translucent fabric jackets, pleated and wrinkled during the passage through the atmosphere, protected beneath fiberglass fairings. Once in space, the blanket would be inflated to form a flexible outer hull somewhat larger than the inner one. It was in that inter-hull space where food would be grown, making use of sunlight that would diffuse through the fabric. It was not clear yet whether each Arklet could be self-sufficient in terms of food production. Probably not. But growing some food was better than growing none. Having some green stuff on board helped reduce the load on the CO2 scrubbers, and having water between humans and space helped stop some incoming radiation. One of the end caps sported a docking port, designated in NASA public relations cant as the front door. It was a bit of a misnomer since it was the only door. Once sealed up inside the pressure hull, the occupants could only get out of it by docking the Arklet to something with breathable air on the other side of it. The opposite end of the Arklet was called the boiler room. Mounted outside of it was the trash can-sized nuclear generator that supplied the Arklet with power. Around that were various fittings for connection of plumbing lines, electrical mains, cooling equipment, and the like, none of which would ever be used except in the case when a number of Arklets decided to dock themselves together and form a semi-permanent cluster. Those sturdy thick rings, where the domes met the main body, served as attachment points for anything of a structural nature, anything that would exert significant forces on the body of the Arklet. Radiating from each of those rings were 8 stubby radial spokes, extending outward to halo-like rings where thrusters and grappling equipment were attached. Those parts were shipped inside of the Arklet, then, once it was in space, extracted through the docking port by spacewalkers and bolted on in zero-G. The halos also served to stiffen and stabilize the inflatable outer hull in Arklets so equipped. But in the first 3 test units, they just projected out into space like bicycle rims, studded with small thruster nozzles and laced through with plumbing. Spanning the distance between the front door halo and the boiler room halo was a single, long, spindly member, hinged at the front, or forward end, so that it could, on command, snap up and out, projecting sideways from the arclet for a distance of about 10 meters. Mounted to the end of this arm were a camera, a target, and an electromechanical grappling device, collectively known as the paw. A cable ran from the paw back down the length of the arm to a reel near the docking port, where 250 meters of it were wound up like thread on a spool. The arm, the paw, the rope, and the reel were all there to achieve a specific maneuver, never before attempted, denoted in official NASA engineering documents as the Bolo coupling operation, but referred to everywhere else as the high five. On day 306, after arclets 2 and 3 had been assembled and checked out, the first Bolo coupling operation was initiated. It happened several kilometers away from Izzy. It was done quietly and secretly, in case it failed, but lots of video was taken, in case it succeeded. The operation had many possible failure modes, which was engineering speak, meaning that it could go wrong in so many different ways that trying to think them all through was impossible. So, each of the two arclets needed to have a qualified pilot, someone who understood orbital mechanics and spaceship propulsion well enough to bring an errant craft back in hand by manual control. Few such people had ever existed, and only 4 of them were aboard Izzy. Right now, down on the ground, thousands of young people selected in the casting of lots were learning how to do it by piloting virtual arclets in video game simulations. But none of those people was ready or in orbit yet. So Ivy ended up at the controls of Arclet 2 with Dinah as passenger and general assistant. Piloting Arclet 3 was a recent arrival, Marcus Luker, a Swiss Air Force pilot turned astronaut and a veteran of 2 previous missions to the ISS. His background piloting high-performance fighter jets through alpine valleys seemed like a reasonable qualification for this job. His assistant was Wang Fu Hua, one of the first Chinese taikonauts to have reached Izzy during the pioneer days of a few months back. After a good night's sleep and a light breakfast, the 4 participants met in the banana to go over the details one last time with engineers on the ground, then ascended a spoke into the weightless environment of H1 and glided up the stack, the central axis of the space station, snaking through work bays and temporary supply dumps until they reached a docking node that, after a few twists and turns, led them into a hamster tube. One after the other, they slithered down it. Dinah, in number 3 position behind Marcus, found it difficult to keep up with him. The soles of his feet kept getting farther and farther away.
"Just like scaling the Daubenhorn,"
he said at one point,
"except without the annoyance of gravity."
"Is that a mountain?" Dinah asked, since the hamster tube was long, and she felt that a bit of light conversation would help ease the lump in her stomach.
"Yes, a famous Klettersteig where I grew up. You must come and give it a try one of these days,"
Marcus called back. A common error in etiquette among people who had only recently arrived at Izzy was to talk about Earth as a place that it was possible to go back to, as if this were a temporary mission like all of the previous ones. Dinah said nothing. Marcus would realize his mistake if he hadn't already.
"Oh, well," he added.
Yes, he had realized it. "What's a Klettersteig?" Dinah asked, trying to move on.
"It is a mountain climb that is pre-engineered with cables, ladders, and so on."
"To make it easier," Dinah guessed.
"Oh no, it is not easy. It is a way to take a climb that would be impossible and make it merely extremely difficult."
"Okay," Dinah said. "A good metaphor for what we are trying to do up here, then."
"Yes, I suppose so,"
Marcus said, cheerfully enough. They came to a junction of hamster tubes, and after scrutinizing the felt-tipped annotations on the walls left by past travelers, they went their separate ways. Dinah leading Ivy to the right, while Fu Hua and Marcus headed straight on. After passing 3 occupied docking ports and exchanging perfunctory greetings with the people living in the capsules on the other sides, they came to the end of the hamster tube and passed through a docking port. They floated into a tubular space 4 meters in diameter and 12 meters long, illuminated by icy bluish-white LEDs. Its wall was a smooth cylinder of aluminum, striped with barcodes and stippled with batch numbers from the mill that had produced it. A long, straight weld ran up its length. At the far end, the curve of its boiler room dome, penetrated by many plumbing and electrical connections, was visible through a flat fiberglass grate. A disc of industrial catwalk material in a bilious shade of green. A ladder made of the same material extended up from there to the front door, through which Dinah and now Ivy entered. It put Dinah immediately in mind of Marcus with his talk of Klettersteigs. You didn't need to have a ladder unless you were expecting gravity, or a reasonable facsimile of it. The grate at the far end of the arclet was going to end up serving as the floor, or as a floor, the lowermost story. The arclet was long enough to divide vertically into as many as 5 stories by inserting more of those grated discs. Cleats for that purpose were attached to the walls at regular intervals, but the grates hadn't been installed yet. Dinah pushed off against the top rung of the ladder and flew down until she could arrest her momentum against the boiler room grate. Then spun herself about so that her feet were touching it and her head was pointed back up toward the front door. This brought her eyes level with several flat panel screens that had been mounted to the walls. They served as status indicators and control panels for the equipment mounted to the outside of the dome. The little nuke was the only thing that mattered to them at the moment. It had a screen all to itself. Dinah woke it up with a tap. It refreshed itself with a graphical display, showing the temperature of the plutonium pellet at its core, its current output level, the RPMs, and health metrics of the Stirling engine that converted its heat into electrical power, and the charge level of the batteries and of the supercapacitor that served as a buffer to store energy when it wasn't needed, and release it when it was. Everything seemed normal there. Not much could really go wrong with these things. This one was brand new. She pivoted to another display that gave her information about the array of thrusters mounted to the halo just outside. Arclets were pretty short on windows. The only place you could see out was at the forward end, where a couple of small portals had been let into the dome adjacent to the docking hardware. Just below one of them was what the engineers called a couch, and what the casual observer would be more likely to describe as an expensive lawn chair that had somehow found its way into space. Ivy had already strapped herself into it and was waking up another bank of flat panel screens there. Dinah could hear her murmuring into the microphone on her headset, which she had jacked into the assortment of plastic boxes that, in this context, passed for a control panel. She was running through a checklist with mission control and talking to Marcus, who by now must be strapped in at the controls of Arclet 3. Gazing around, Dinah saw the gleam of a camera lens, no larger than a raven's eye, set into a tiny plastic pod on the wall in the middle of the arclet. Then, for no particular reason, she started crying. There'd been surprisingly little of this. Certain Morse code messages from Rufus were guaranteed to turn on the old waterworks. Ivy and Dinah permitted themselves to shed tears in each other's presence when no one else was around, and a few other people, such as Louisa, had joined that club more recently. But there was always something to do, some emergency to take care of, always people around watching. No privacy. This empty arclet was the largest volume of uninterrupted, unoccupied space that Dinah had been inside since boarding the Soyuz capsule at Baikonur 1.5 years ago. It seemed vast to her, and she felt alone in it, and she couldn't help herself. She knew that the camera was watching her, and that she was being recorded on digital video that was being archived. Psychologists in Houston might be judging her fitness for duty at this very moment. But she didn't care. She'd stopped caring about what the people in Houston thought a long time ago. When she started crying, it developed a kind of unstoppable momentum, and she just had to let it run for a while. Her thoughts had begun to ramble away from her own family and situation and toward the Arkers who would live and die in tin cans like this one. If it didn't work, if the whole Cloud Ark idea was just a panacea, as some people suggested, then the last thoughts and impressions ever recorded by a human soul might take place in an environment exactly like this one. And maybe Dinah would be that soul. The problem with crying in zero-G was that tears didn't run down your cheeks. They built up in jiggling sacks around your eyes, and you had to shake them off or dab them away. Dinah didn't have anything to dab with. The plastic coveralls they wore were notoriously non-absorbent. And so she just drifted in the bottom of the arklet, looking at the light from the control screens through bags of warm salt water.
"Some assistant you are,"
Ivy called back, after letting her go on for a few minutes.
"Sorry," Dinah blurted out. "That was mission critical."
"Try not to short out any of the equipment. Tears conduct electricity."
"I think they made it all pee-proof. Remember, these things are designed for amateurs."
"Tell me about it,"
Ivy snorted.
"The user interface is so easy to use, I can't do anything."
Something light whacked into Dinah's head. Through the tears, she vaguely saw a white object caroming off the nuclear reactor's user-friendly control panel. Pawing it out of the air, her hands recognized it as a packet of tissues, a high-value black market item. She tore it open, pulled out a few sheets, and began the somewhat delicate process of soaking up the tear globs without smashing them into sprays of equipment-shorting droplets.
"I mean, my God, what would Marcus think of you?"
Ivy demanded. It took Dinah a few moments to catch up.
"Him and me? You think?"
"It is so obvious."
After a thrilling first few weeks, things had kind of trailed off with Reese. It was okay. Easy come, easy go. She had never seen him as a stable long-term prospect. The times they'd been living in, and the place they'd been living, weren't really conducive to long-term pair bonding. Louisa, wearing her anthropologist hat, had watched the spontaneous, mostly short-lived couplings of Izzy's inhabitants with a combination of dry amusement, scientific fascination, and frank, hilarious envy.
"I don't know," Dinah said. "I see where you're going, but he seems a little Captain Kirk."
"You need a little Captain Kirk in your..."
"In my what?"
"In your life. Reese is too introspective."
"Is that a euphemism of some kind?"
"He's depressed."
"Gosh, I wonder why."
"No, not that way. Not about the world ending and everyone dying. I mean that when he's working on a project, he's full of energy, but when it's finished, he just kind of collapses."
On the tip of Dinah's tongue was a remark about how well that observation aligned with Reese's lovemaking style, but she held back.
"You realize that all of this is being recorded?"
"Get used to it,"
Ivy said, and Dinah could sense her shrug from 12 meters away.
"Hang on. Gonna give the forward thrusters a little pop. Backing out of our parking space."
She wasn't kidding. The thrusters gave off something very like a bang when they went off. Dinah, who wasn't actually hanging on, felt a few moments of disorientation as the whole arklet moved backward around her while she remained motionless. The green grid dropped away from her and the front door approached, but all so slowly that she needed only to reach out and glide a hand along the ladder to control her relative motion. In a few seconds, the forward end of the arklet reached her, and she stopped herself against one of the struts of Ivy's couch. Next to it was a knot of straps and pads like a rock-climbing harness, which Dinah now spent a couple of minutes untangling and climbing into. The bangs of the thrusters, the hisses and clicks of the associated plumbing, and Ivy's murmuring into the microphone served as accompaniment while she got herself strapped in and donned a headset of her own. That enabled her to hear the clipped military-style transmissions among Ivy, Marcus, and their controller on Izzy. An engineer in Houston weighed in every few minutes with questions and observations. Once they had drifted well clear of Izzy, they initiated a programmed burn a few seconds long that took them to a slightly higher orbit. For a while, they could see nothing but empty space through their windows. The sun must have risen over the Earth's limb, because bright round spots appeared on the wall. Ivy said, "I have three on radar and am engaging MAP." That being the three-letter acronym for Monitored Autonomous Piloting. The operation they were about to perform, the High Five, was deemed way too ticklish to be handled by noob spaceship pilots. It had to be a robotic operation the whole way, but the algorithms and the sensors that told them what was happening were all brand new, so experienced pilots had to sit at the controls, watching through the window, and taking over if and when the robo-pilot started acting screwy. The thrusters began to pop in a different rhythm, a patter of tiny firings very different from how a human being would operate them. The starfield swung past the windows. The splotches of sunlight veered around the walls, and suddenly, Arklet 3 rotated into view, a few hundred meters away. It, too, was flying under MAP, coming about until its front door was aimed their way. Dinah stifled the impulse to wave at Marcus and Fu Hua. It was unprofessional, and anyway, they wouldn't be able to see her through the tiny porthole. A spindly white arm swung outward from the side of Arklet 3 and locked into position, extended off to one side. A few moments later, they heard and felt their own arm actuating likewise, and watched an animation of it on a flat screen. "Bringing up the paw camera," Dinah muttered, and tapped a control that flooded a screen with high-resolution video from a telephoto lens mounted at the end of the arm. This showed nothing, at first, but the blue limb of the Earth's atmosphere down in one corner. Then, a target-like pattern veered across the screen, slowed, and veered back. All of this was accompanied by more fidgety percussion from the thrusters. The feed was remarkably close and clear. Comparing it to the direct view out of the porthole, Dinah could see the target on the end of Arklet 3's extended arm, looking tiny from this distance. But the machine vision system now in control of their little spacecraft had found it and recognized it and, "We have a lock," Ivy said. "We see you, Three."
"We see you, Two,"
Marcus answered.
"It proceeds."
It proceeded with a long firing of the aft thrusters that nudged them forward enough that Dinah could feel the pressure on her bottom, sense the straps of the harness tightening. The target flailed around some, but a few moments later, the lock was reestablished. Dinah could see Arklet 3 growing larger, numbers on a screen gauging the distance between the ships or, to be precise, between the two ships' outstretched paws, were counting down.
"It is all nominal," Ivy said,
but the last word was drowned out by a digital voice making an announcement over the Arklet's rudimentary PA system. "Bolo coupling operation entering its terminal phase. Prepare for acceleration." And then, in classic NASA style, it counted down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Grapple initiated. At 1, the test pattern on the screen disappeared in shadow, for it was too close now for the camera to even see it. The paws of Arklet 2 and Arklet 3 slapped together like runners exchanging a high five as they passed each other going opposite ways. Strange, whiny noises propagated down the arm into the hard shell of the Arklet. "Grappling achieved," said the voice. Dinah's ears finally identified the whiny noise as the sound of cable unwinding from a spool. She felt a lurch in her stomach as the Arklet did a half-somersault, reversing its direction so that it was pointed back at its Bolo partner.
As she knew, having studied this maneuver for weeks, the two arclets were now joined together by a cable. They had flown right past each other, but the tension on that cable had spun them around so that they were pointing toward each other again. She verified this with a glance out the window, which gave her a view of the nose of Arclet 3 slowly receding as it backed away from them. The spool of cable mounted next to its docking port was in motion, unwinding as the two craft gained distance from each other. In the exact center, the cables of Arclets 2 and 3 were clasped together by a coupling device that could be remotely disengaged whenever they made the decision to go their separate ways.
"Congratulations, Bolo 1," said the engineer down in Houston. "The first autonomously driven coupling of two spacecraft to create a rotating system for production of Earth-normal simulated gravity."
Earth swung past beneath the other half of Bolo 1, and Dinah felt the awareness of her own throat that would culminate, 5 minutes from now, in vomiting. The two arclets were already swinging slowly around each other, producing a small amount of simulated gravity, even less than what they experienced in the banana. But the map system wasn't satisfied with that. Once the two arclets were far enough apart not to take damage from each other's thruster exhaust, the system initiated a longer burn that, in combination with the slow unrolling of the cables, put their inner ears through some disturbing changes. The sound of the cable reels changed as automatic brakes engaged to slow their unwinding and avoid a damaging jerk at the end. Then there was silence for a few moments, and then another thruster burn, longer and directed laterally, to speed up the Bolo's rotational velocity.
"Holy shit!"
was the only thing that Dinah could say for the first minute or two. They were experiencing 1G, Earth normal gravity, for the first time in over a year. Marcus, who'd only been in orbit for a few days, sounded great. To judge from what they were hearing in their headsets, he had unstrapped from his pilot's couch and was clambering all over Arclet 3 as if it were the Daubenhorn. Ivy and Dinah couldn't move for several minutes, and Dinah seriously entertained the possibility that she was dying.
"Can you pass out while you're lying down?" she finally asked.
"Remain in your positions,"
a voice from Houston was saying dimly, distantly, as if shouting at them through a bullhorn from 400 kilometers below.
"It is a long fall to the bottom of that arclet."
A long fall. Dinah had ceased to even think in terms of up and down. The concept of falling had become meaningless to her. When you were in orbit, you were always falling, but you never hit anything. She risked turning her head to look at the great below, and that was the trigger that forced her to reach for her barf bag. Day 333. Dube had known for a while that he was not the easiest guy to be related to. During his last 10 weeks on Earth, however, he sometimes feared he was pushing his family's patience beyond human limits with his lust for camping. Until then, his idea of a satisfying outdoor experience had been to saunter out onto the terrace of a European hotel to smoke cigars and drink brandy. His duties as an astronomer sometimes called him to remote locations, such as the summit of Mauna Kea, where he would dutifully go outside, freeze his ass off for a few minutes, remark on the awesomeness of the view and the clarity of the air, and then go back inside to sit behind a workstation and stare at images on a screen. Camping and the outdoor life in general simply hadn't been a part of the culture of his family, which tended to look with favor on being under a sound roof, in a heated space, behind locked doors, with plenty of food baking and frying in a modern, fully appointed kitchen. He had always admired his colleagues in the life and earth sciences who could hit the road on short notice with a fully stocked backpack and live rugged, adventuresome lives in exotic locales. But he had admired them from a distance. His sojourn to Moses Lake with Henry had turned him into a late convert to the outdoor life and left him with a considerable stock of state-of-the-art gear
that he was strangely eager to use. The visit to Bhutan had also been a trigger. This had been preceded by a lengthy series of flights across the Pacific and a brief stay on an aircraft carrier, cramped, crowded, artificial environments, not unlike where he would be spending the remainder of his days. Then, just for a blessed few hours, he had climbed out of that chopper into the high, cold, piney air of Bhutan and gone for a ramble in the King's Land Rover and hiked up a misty mountain that had struck him as being straight from a 1970s album cover. And he had done some introspection about the fact that he couldn't even take such a lovely place at face value, but only liken it to such pop culture references. A few hours later, he had been back on the aircraft carrier with Dorji and Jigme, and about 100 other Arkers, who had been collected in a similar manner from Myanmar, Bangladesh, Nepal, various provinces of India, Sri Lanka, and scattered island groups. He had been struck by the contrast between how centered, how natural, how autochthonous the Bhutanese youths had looked when he had first seen them on the side of the cliff in their home country, and how lost they appeared in the painted steel companionway of an aircraft carrier, mixed up with other South Asians in equally colorful garb, all equally alienated from their native soil, all looking for a place to stow their priceless cultural artifacts. He had come home with the idea in his head that he needed to get a little bit of native soil on himself before getting shot up to a place where he would be every bit as lost and alienated as Dorji and Jigme had been aboard USS George H.W. Bush, which seemed uncontroversial to him. But when he presented the plan to Tav over a cup of naval coffee in one of the aircraft carrier's eateries, Tav demurred.
"You are totally over-romanticizing dirt."
Tav liked to play the devil's advocate. He and Dube had had many such conversations. Dube shrugged and said,
"Let's say you're right. What's the worst that could happen if I get some dirt on me while I still have access to dirt?"
"Tetanus?"
"Before they started sending me to places like this, they made sure I was up to date on my shots."
"No, seriously. I just don't buy it, Dube."
"Buy what? What is it you think I'm trying to sell you?"
"You're trying to sell me the idea that there is such a thing as a state of nature that humans were designed to live in. It is the dirt is good hypothesis."
"But obviously we evolved in rustic outdoor settings. Those places are, in a sense, natural to us."
"But we did evolve, Dube. We're not animals. We evolved into organisms that could make things like this."
Tav waved his free hand around at the painted steel environs of the aircraft carrier.
"And this."
He raised his coffee cup and clinked it against Dube's.
"Which is a good thing, you're saying."
"Compared to being torn apart by hyenas? Yeah, obviously, it's a good thing."
"Well, I'm not going to get torn apart by hyenas. I'm just going to go camping."
Tav smiled in a way that seemed a little forced.
"You don't get what I'm saying, do you?"
He said,
"Look, you know my views on the singularity. On uploading."
"I did blurb your book on the topic."
"Yes, thank you for that."
Tav was referring to the idea that the human brain could, in principle, be digitized and uploaded into a computer, that this would one day happen on a large scale, that it might actually have happened already, that we might all, in fact, be living in a giant digital simulation. Something occurred to Dube.
"Is that why you were grilling the king about his views on reincarnation?"
"That's part of it,"
Tav admitted.
"Look, all I'm saying is that if you've gone where I've already gone in terms of thinking about that..."
"If you've drunk the singularity Kool-Aid, in other words,"
Dube said.
"Yeah, Dube, as you know I've already done." "Then you've already made a fundamental break with trying to be nature boy. I am never going to be Nature Boy. I believe that the human mind is almost infinitely malleable and that people are going to adjust within days or weeks to life on the Cloud Ark. We will simply turn into a different civilization altogether from the one we grew up in. Our whole idea of nature will be forgotten. And 1,000 years from now, people will go on camping trips that will consist of sleeping in arklets, drinking tang, and peeing into tubes just like their ancestors did.
To them,
Dube said,
that'll be a back-to-nature experience.
I think that's how we will see it, yes,
Tav said. Dube considered uttering the punchline to the famous joke, "Who's we, white man?" But he thought better of it. For the next few weeks, his duties had taken him to various other parts of the world, making what Mario the photographer referred to as abduction runs, and conveying the victims to Archer training camps, where they would spend the rest of their time on Earth playing elaborate video games about orbital mechanics. Tavistock Prowse showed up for some of these. When he wasn't doing that, he was making social media posts about the themes he had articulated in his conversation on the aircraft carrier. And when Dube clicked through to those posts, he was always impressed by the number of people who were reading them. Tav was developing a following and a reputation as an important thinker about the sociology of the upcoming space-based civilization. Whenever Dube got a few days downtime, he would swoop down on a part of the country where one of his kids was living and grab them and take them camping. Henry had taken up residence at Moses Lake permanently, or as permanently as anything could be in this world. That was his youngest. Hadley, the girl in the middle, was in Berkeley. She'd been doing volunteer work for an organization in Oakland and had a lot of free time. Dube would drag her away on day hikes to Mount Tam, or longer sojourns in the Sierras. Hesper, his oldest, lived outside of D.C. with her boyfriend, a military man stationed at the Pentagon. The last camping trip happened in early October. Dube still had a few weeks left, but he knew he would spend most of it in training, or talking about training on TV. In the weeks to come, he might be able to play hooky and go out on the occasional afternoon hike. But the fact of the matter was that the next time he bedded down in a sleeping bag, it would be in zero gravity, in the cozy environs of a windowless aluminum can. Perhaps sensing that, Amelia had flown out on the spur of the moment. Normally, she'd have been teaching school at this point in the year, but the schedule had become fluid. It was difficult to sustain the illusion that education was of value for kids who would not live long enough to use it. They'd never take the standardized tests that they were prepping for. In a way, Amelia had said, this had led to a kind of renaissance in pedagogy. Free from the constraints of racking up high test scores or getting into colleges, students could learn for learning's sake, which was how it ought to be. The tick-tock curriculum had dissolved and been replaced by activities improvised from day to day by teachers and parents. Hiking in the mountains, doing art projects about the Cloud Ark, talking with psychologists about death, reading favorite books. In one sense, Amelia and her colleagues had never been more needed, never had such an opportunity to show their quality. At the same time, the routine had loosened up enough for Amelia to take a couple of days off, hop a plane to D.C., surprise Dube, and drive up into the mountains with him and Hesper and Enrique to enjoy the fall foliage. Dube had never made a real connection to Enrique, a half-black, half-Puerto Rican, all-American Army sergeant from the Bronx. But now, sitting on the tailgate of a rented SUV, snuggled under a blanket with Amelia, looking out over a rolling mountain vista gorgeous with fall color, and waiting for some sausages to heat up on the hibachi, Dube felt as close to the guy as he could to anyone. Enrique seemed to sense the thawing in his mood.
"What are you going to build up there?"
he asked. It said something about how much Dube had changed in the last year that he didn't let out a derisive snort. His face did not even change, or so he told himself. He looked over at Amelia, sitting next to him, for confirmation. She'd been trying to help Dube out. For the kids, she explained. It doesn't matter what you think, Dubois, or what you feel. It's not about you. It's not even about science. Right now, it's about telling the kids in my classroom what it is that they have to hope for. So shut up and get it done. These things were important. It wasn't just a matter of hiding what you really felt. If you hid your feelings well enough, it actually changed you. A few months ago, Dube would have betrayed cynicism, possibly long enough for Enrique to notice it. And a few months before that, he might have launched into a detailed explanation of why he was cynical, making it clear that the Cloud Arc was going to be an experiment in hastily improvised survival against nearly impossible odds. None of that happened. He looked at the faces of Enrique and of Hesper, lit on one side by blue twilight and on the other by the glow of the coals, and he answered the question. He answered it as if he were standing in front of a television camera streaming live to the internet.
The resources up there are basically infinite. That was true even before the moon blew up. Now it has been busted open like a piñata. All it needs is to be shaped into the right architecture. Enclosed habitations that we can fill with air and fertilize with the genetic heritage of the Earth. That's going to take a while. And we'll go through some tough times first. It's going to be tough emotionally when the hard rain hits, and we have to say goodbye to all that was. And it's going to be tough afterward, when the Arkers have to learn how to work together and make hard choices. By far, the biggest challenge humanity has ever faced. But we'll survive. We'll use what's up there to build incubators for our heritage to live in, to grow, and to improve on what we brought with us. And eventually, the day will come when we return. The hard rain won't last forever. Oh, it'll last for many lifetimes. As long as human civilization has existed until now. And what it is going to leave behind will be a hot and rocky wasteland. But by that point, many generations will have devoted all of their hopes and their creative genius to the problem of remaking the world as well as, or better than, what we see here. We will come back. And that's the real answer, Enrique. Will we survive? Yeah. It'll be touch and go, but we will survive. Will we build space habitats? Absolutely. Small ones at first, big ones later. But that's not the real goal. The real goal will take thousands of years. The real goal is to build Earth again, and build it better.
It was the first time he'd said it this way, but it wasn't the last. In the next few weeks, his last weeks on Earth, he'd say it again to television cameras, to the president, to a stadium full of Arkers in training. All he knew at the time was that Enrique was nodding in a way that said, "It's going to be okay. Dube's got this." And Hesper was snuggling her head against Enrique's powerful shoulder, eyes gleaming, staring into the future that her father was conjuring with those words. Behind her, a meteor knifed across the twilight sky and exploded out over the Atlantic. Cloud Arc, Day 365.
Today we're going to talk about what it really means to have a swarm of arklets in orbit,
said famous astronomer and science pundit Doc Dubois. He was hovering in the center of Arklet 2, currently docked to Izzy. He was wearing a pressure suit with its helmet detached and slung under his arm. He was talking into one of the Arklet's built-in high-def video cameras, trusting that some computer somewhere was recording the footage.
"Cut,"
he said. Then he felt a little sheepish. He was producing and editing his own videos now, so he had just said cut to himself. In space, there were no video crews, photographers, production assistants,
or makeup artists to follow you around. He rather liked it that way. But there was something to be said for having at least one other human in the room who could react to what you were saying. He needed Amelia there, silently shaking her head or nodding. Instead of which, he tried to imagine that he was talking to the kids in her classroom in South Pasadena on a sunny Tuesday morning. He replayed his own dialogue in their ears.
"What it really means,"
sounded skeptical, as if everything said on the topic heretofore had been a bunch of BS. And in orbit wasn't really necessary. Everyone knew that they were in orbit.
"Today we're going to talk about what it means to have a swarm of arclets,"
he said.
"In normal space, like on Earth, we use three numbers to tell where something is. Left, right, forward, back, up, down. The X, Y, and Z axes from your high school geometry class. Turns out that this doesn't work so well in orbit. Up here we need six numbers to fully specify what orbit an object, such as an arclet, happens to be in. Three for position, but another three for velocity. If you've got two objects that share the same six numbers, they're in the same place. Right now, my six numbers are the same as those of this arclet that I'm floating in, and so we're moving through space together. But if one or more of my numbers changed, you'd see me drifting."
Doob had brought with him a small can of compressed air, a common convenience used by electronics technicians to blow dust away from things they were working on. He aimed it down toward the aft end of the arclet and pressed the button. Air hissed out, and he began drifting up toward the front door. He raised a hand above his head in time to kill his upward motion against the forward bulkhead, then turned to look into a different camera. Good. It was the third time he'd attempted this, and he was running out of canned air.
"I can't drift far, confined as I am to the pressure hull. But you can imagine that if I hadn't been able to stop, if I'd been out on a spacewalk, I might have drifted a long way. And what the science of orbital mechanics tells us is that no two objects in orbit can have the same six numbers, except in the special case I just showed you, where I was inside the hollow arclet so that both of our centers of gravity could coincide. An arclet, or any other object, that is off the port side of Izzy, or to starboard, or to the zenith, or nadir side of it, or forward or aft of it, has different numbers by definition. It's in a different orbit. And so it is going to drift."
He mentally reviewed his notes. Here he had intended to be more specific about the nature of that drift. If it's in a higher orbit, it'll fall behind. If it's in a lower orbit, it'll race ahead. If it's off to one side or the other, it'll converge, then diverge on a 93-minute cycle. Only if it's directly forward or directly aft will it maintain the same relative position. But he thought maybe he could link that out to a different video, one with more graphics. Better to get to the point.
"The moral of the story? In space, there is no such thing as formation flying. Physics will cause two nearby objects to drift closer together or farther away. If you want to preserve a formation, such as a swarm, you have only two options. Physically connect the arclets together so that they become one object, or else use the thrusters to correct for the drift."
There was another option, which was to put them in single file, like a train in space, but it didn't seem very swarm-like, and so he left it out of the reckoning for now. Minutes after the video was posted, outraged YouTube commentators would be all over him, pointing out the error and attributing it to dishonesty, incompetence, and/or a conspiracy. His last task was to record a voiceover that would be played over footage of young arcers training in huge industrial video arcades, thrown together for just that purpose in places like Houston and Baikonur.
It's not difficult to learn this stuff. Any video gamer can pick it up in a few minutes. Just ask these young Arkers, brought together from all over the world, who've been honing their Arklet piloting skills using precision simulators. Most of the time, of course, the Arklets will be flying themselves on autopilot. But if and when it's necessary for a human to take the controls, these young people will be ready for it.
The task complete, he established a link between his tablet and the wireless network of this Arklet, and spent a few minutes moving video files around so that he could edit them later. Catching sight of himself in freeze-framed thumbnails, he was struck by the roundness of his face. A typical symptom of zero-G as the body retrained itself in how to distribute fluids through its tissues. Up here, it was the mark of the newbie. Doob had been in space for 6 days. This was A plus 1.0, 1 year to the day since he had stood in the Athenium and watched the moon disintegrate. Arklet 2, now outmoded by newer models, was docked at the far end of a hamster tube on the port